Welcome to Elevate, the podcast where trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravapudi talk about the real issues that come with the fight for justice. So let's find inspiration in the wins. Let's learn from the losses. But most of all, let's keep learning and getting better and keep getting back in the ring. Are you ready to elevate your own trial practice, law firm, and life? Let's get started. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Hey, it's Ben. Raul and I started this podcast because we love hanging out with fellow trial lawyers and sharing ideas that can make us all better. And both of our firms also regularly collaborate with other lawyers across the countries in cases where we can add value. If you're interested in collaboration, or even if you just have a case or an idea that you want to bounce off us or brainstorm, Raul and I are going to be hosting confidential case workshops the first Wednesday of each month. So here's how it works. If you have a case or an idea that you want to talk about or brainstorm with us, just send me an email to ben@elevate.net, E-L-A-W-V-A-T-E.net, or go online to elevate.net and submit a case workshop request. We will schedule you for a confidential 30-minute Zoom meeting where we can talk about your case to see if we can help. If you feel like there would be good value in collaborating on the case further, we can talk about that. If not, that's okay too. We enjoy helping other trial lawyers because we know someday you'd be willing to do the same for us if we needed your help. So again, if you're interested in workshopping your case with us, just send an email to ben@elevate.net or fill out a case workshop request at elevate.net, and Rahul and I will look forward to chatting with you soon. Today's episode of the Elevate podcast is brought to you by Filevine. Filevine has a software program called Lead Docket, which is the gold standard for managing your new case intakes and leads, your Glengarry leads, your Glenn Ross leads, and all of your other leads. So check them out at Filevine and manage your leads. We're also brought to you by Steno. Rahul, you guys work with Steno.
Steno is the best in court reporting services, not just in court reporting services, but even some of their technology tools. We're talking about AI a little bit on this podcast and their transcript genius, where they can summarize and take interrogatories based on deposition transcripts, is so useful. If you haven't tried it, definitely try it.
We're brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal does digital marketing, web development for trial firms. It's owned by our good friends, Micah and Tyler. They recently redeveloped our firm's website, so you can check our website out. If you like it, give them a call and they can help you out too. And finally, we're brought to you by Expert Institute. Rahul, you guys work with them, right?
We both use Expert Institute because you always need to be cutting edge in the experts that we use in our cases. Going to the repeat experts every single time is going to make you a lesser lawyer. And you always want to keep up. And the best way to do that is with Expert Institute.
Good morning and welcome to the Elevate podcast. I'm Ben Gideon. Rahul is off today, back in the social media trial. So we'll look forward to hearing from him how that's going once he concludes. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Bo Frazier. Morning, Bo.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
And Bo is coming to us from California, right? Where are you actually today?
I'm in San Diego. That's where I live.
Nice. And I was kind of joking that I was late to the show here, even though it's 9 a.m. in the East Coast where I am and only 6 a.m. where you are. So appreciate you getting out of bed this morning. I don't know if you're typically an early riser, but...
No, I'm definitely not a 5:45 wake up kind of guy normally, but no problem to do it for this.
So Bo and I have gotten to know each other from working together on a couple of cases, and I've really enjoyed working with you, Bo, and learning from you. So how do you describe yourself? You're obviously a jury consultant on some level, but I feel like you're more than that because you've helped us with other elements of the trial, case framing, trial strategies. What title do you typically go by?
Right. I like to use the term trial consultant for that reason, to not pigeonhole to jury selection, which is sort of the bread and butter offering that people usually come to me for, is I need someone to pick my jury. Can you help me? People don't realize a lot of what I do comes long before the jury selection process begins. not just preparing for jury selection, but opening statement preparation, witness preparation, mock trials. So much happens long before we get to the courtroom. So that's a big part of what we do.
So I was first introduced to you and your mom by Charla Aldous and Brent Walker, who I know you've worked with quite a bit, right?
That's right. Charla's a great client and a friend.
In the first case we worked on, initially we worked together with you and your mom, and then you came up and helped us pick our jury in that case. Just kind of curious, you don't see a lot of mother-son, you know, business partner teams. Can you give us kind of the backstory on that? And how did you come to this, you know, somewhat unique line of work?
Yeah, so all credit to my mom for pulling me into this. We both have PhDs in social psychology. My mom, Jane, was a practicing therapist for many years, 20 years almost, even though that's not normally what social psychologists do. She got licensed to do therapy, and she did that in Dallas. And that's all I remember growing up, was her being like a shrink. And there was some lady named Lisa Blue met my mom at, I forget what event in Dallas, and they hit it off. They had a friendship, and Lisa kind of thought that my mom had potential to pick juries. And at the time, Lisa was wanting to focus more. My understanding is that she wanted to focus more on the trial lawyer part, because as you know, jury selection is so upside down world compared to what you do the rest of trial. She sort of wanted to outsource that part of her brain to someone else, and so they could pick the jury and she could focus on being a lawyer. And so she taught Jane, and Jane was a very fast learner. And one thing led to another, and you know, Jane kind of started at the top because she was trained by Lisa and also had her sort of endorsement. And she hit the ground running and was so great at what she does. I took that for granted as a kid and adolescent, not realizing what a badass, I don't know if we're allowed to say that here, my mom was. And I kind of tried to not take over the family business. It sounded like the easy way out, not necessarily what my vision for my future was. I tried to become Don Draper after grad school, go into advertising and marketing. And I realized what a cool job was right in front of me all along. Not only was it, you know, a great career, but it's so interesting. Every day is so different. Clients are eager to hire you as long as you do a good job, which was totally different than marketing, where budgets are slim and so much competition. It was just a much more enjoyable field to work in. And so despite my best efforts, I got pulled into the family business. And any concerns about, you know, working with your mom were kind of a non-issue because we so love what we do. I mean, we text each other all the time. It's been an interesting addition to our family dynamic, is now being colleagues and just being so interested in what the other's doing. How's the jury? You know, all we can think about is, how's your jury? How'd it go? And you sort of develop this just love for your field. And so that maybe is genetic. I'm not sure. But that's sort of the story of how I became a jury consultant, thanks to Jane, my mom.
Do you need a PhD in, what did you say, social science? Or what is your PhD?
You definitely don't need a PhD to become a jury consultant. I do think it adds a lot of value. Other common fields that people come from are obviously law. You see sometimes attorneys become jury consultants. I've also seen people with communications degrees, master's or PhD, become consultants. I think social psychology is particularly suited, conducive toward this field of work, because one is the research background. You know, doing mock trials and having this pre-trial research component to what we do, it's so helpful coming from a real scientific background. We are much more rigorous in the way we recruit participants than other people, than other firms. We refuse to take people who are serial research participants who participate in focus groups and mock trials all the time. That's just one example of how we kind of take our recruitment more seriously. Having a research background enables you to design your studies in a little bit more of a controlled way. Sometimes we'll run two groups where you manipulate a variable in one group and don't manipulate it in the other. The other reason is there's so many principles of social psychology that come into play in a courtroom. Persuasion, you know, leadership, clusters developing in the jury. Really, the number one and most easy to explain social psychological principle that affects what we do is bad is stronger than good. That's actually the title of the most widely cited social psychology article in history, at least at the time I was in grad school, which has been a few years now. But the general idea is negative valence stimuli are so much more powerful and persuasive than positive valence stimuli. And that's why when we do opening statements together, almost exclusively focused on the bad acts of the defendant, as opposed to the redeeming qualities of the plaintiff. Especially early in your case, no one cares about you or your plaintiff yet. You're not going to win them with, here, we're the good guy and here's why story. Following a villain and getting mad at a villain is so much more in our nature, especially when we're in a situation where we don't know the context yet. We hardly know the characters. You're more likely to win someone over with hate for the bad guy than love for the good guy. So that's just that's rooted in social psychology. You know, that's not necessarily something you need a social psychology degree to understand or implement, but having that background, there are opportunities to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, I think that based on this study or this rule or principle, we have pretty good reason to believe that this is how this dynamic will play out, and this would be the most effective path forward.
I mean, that certainly rings true from the cases I've tried and my own life experience, but talk to us a little bit more about that, because that, what you just said on its face seems very straightforward, but implementing that in the context of a case can be challenging and seems like trying to identify what is going to cause somebody to get angry or perceive someone as a villain. Sometimes I feel like we think there are things that cause someone to be perceived as a villain, but they aren't necessarily. We misjudge that because we're too deep into the weeds of the case, you know, or in a medical case, maybe the medicine, but jurors might be willing to give a free pass on something that to them sounds disingenuous when we're arguing it. So just how do you go about figuring out what is that point of leverage in a case that allows you to generate that emotional attraction with the jury?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And some lawyers have the curse of knowledge and they're drinking the Kool-Aid of their case from day one. I'm not saying they're totally blind to the weaknesses, but what happens a lot of time is exactly like you said, it seems really strong. It seems like a great point to you or the attorney, but either they can't communicate it effectively or it just doesn't hit the same way they think it hits. So a lot of my job is to really get in, because the attorney's feeling it. You know, I can tell this is meaningful to you. Like, help me get there. Help me get that feeling so I can translate it to normal layperson speak and try to deliver that same point in a way that someone who's just been introduced to this case can A, understand, and B, be comparably persuaded to the extent that the Kool-Aid drinking lawyer is persuaded. There's a lot of ways to kind of amp up the nefariousness of a bad act. When I get brought into a case, there's two lists I just start writing from the very first kickoff meeting. There's the voir dire list. These are the topics I need to address in voir dire. I know these are going to be our Achilles heels, and I just start making that list. The other one is the tick-off factors list. All the things that I'm hearing that have potential to make a jury mad. A lot of times those tick-off factors are best understood by explaining to the jury what should have been done. If a doctor really cared about their patient, here's what they would have done. Juries don't appreciate wrongdoing until right doing, so to speak, has had light shined on it. Whether it's, you know, an industry norm that people don't realize that pre-shift safety meetings are not some going over the top measure that a construction company needs to take. It's actually standard practice. And if you don't have pre-shift safety meetings, you're cutting corners. Jurors who aren't familiar with construction have no idea how common or normal these things are. This could be framed by the defense as, you know, we even had pre-shift construction meetings. Look how awesome and above and beyond we are. Or the plaintiff could take the same thing and say, they only had pre-shift construction meetings once a week, but they work 6 days a week. I mean, the same fact could be framed in two different ways. The most useful tactic from case to case on this point is to inform jurors what's the norm. They don't know what the norm is. And as the plaintiff going first, you have the advantage of establishing the norm early. If the defendant really cared, here's the things they would have done. And very often, if you get granular and make a list, you can really get impactful with all the corners they cut. Did they follow up with her after her initial appointment? No. Waited 5 days for the next communication. Or, you know, we worked on stuff like that where you really have to think about, you know, not only what they did, but what they didn't do and could have done.
So, I mean, big point, bad's more important than good in terms of motivating people to take action. Are there other kind of themes of social psychology that you see as common threads that run through trials or trial prep and jury selection?
Yeah, there's tons. So I think sort of an expression that we use a lot of the time is, if you get really mad, the jury feels like they don't have to. And I tell that to attorneys who get really amped up in their tone, or witnesses too. If a witness is on the stand and takes the reins in terms of being mad at the defendant or getting upset or aggressive with opposing counsel, the jury feels like someone has assumed the role of the defender, the, you know, the Batman, the person who's going to do something about justice. So I always recommend that attorneys lead them to that point where they can get angry themselves, but don't take that responsibility away from them. Because if you take that position, it's like that job has been completed by someone else, and the jury can just kind of sit back and let you be the angry guy. There's a number of other, you know, areas in which psychology comes into play, but that one comes to mind because we have a nice kind of saying expression around it. You get mad, the jury doesn't have to.
Hadn't heard that before, but it makes a lot of sense. One of the things I've really enjoyed in the process working with you guys is we tend to put a lot of detail and focus into our case, and we like to give our best shot at putting something together. We put together an opening typically before you get involved. That way we're not using you as a crutch to do our job for us or to, you know, figure out the details of the case, because we think it's important we can do that. But then you come in and help us really clarify and simplify, starting with the kind of clay we have and helping us mold it into something that's much more simple and easy to understand to lay people, and maybe more highlights the more salient and important elements of it. Is that a typical process that you follow, or do you tend to, you know, start earlier with other clients? Tell us a little bit about how your process usually works, and what's the ideal way to work with you guys?
There's a huge degree of variability in what situation I'm in when we come in for those opening statement workshop days. People don't realize those opening statement workshop days are more grueling on my end as a jury consultant, even than picking a jury, believe it or not. Picking a jury is high stakes, fast moving, really intense. But something about those opening statement workshops, because you're taking hodgepodge of facts that you've been given. Sometimes you've had multiple meetings beforehand. Other times I learn about the case as I walk into that opening statement meeting. It's just, you're taking it from one state and converting it into another, and it better be good because they're paying you for it. So it's a lot, something about what it makes your brain do is very challenging, because you're reformatting this information into something that's persuasive and in a way artistic. I mean, it is supposed to be aesthetically appealing, persuasive, concise. And it's like Mark Twain said, I would have written a shorter story if I had more time. So a lot of it's, how do I take all this information and get it into this small format? It's so much more helpful when the homework has been done beforehand. And I know a day, a week before what the case is about. I can start thinking of options for my 1, 2, 3 acts and chapters. You know, we follow the Cliff Atkinson Beyond Bullet Points method. It allows me to sort, even if it's subconsciously, just sort of prepare, get some ideas and inspiration, and then come back to you guys, just like you, Gideon, Asen comes to me with a rough draft of what they have in mind. I can sort of come in and say, hey, I think this would be cool, but I'm missing a couple facts to make it really great. And so you get more impressive output if you do some prep. A lot of the hard part is really taking the story and digesting it, and then having time to do that is really crucial. Teaser, spoiler alert, I'm actually working on an AI tool to help with this whole process, not only for me, but for attorneys who might want a killer opening statement, but don't have the budget for someone like me, especially for every single case. As I was making this AI tool, I realized what an important part of the process it is to go from getting the case info to just beginning this meeting. That's sort of I didn't realize what a big part of my job that was, because I just think of the creating the PowerPoint, that's kind of the deliverable. But that phase where you go from hearing about the case to just beginning the PowerPoint there's a lot going on in one's brain, you know, that AI is going to, I'm really interested to see what AI is able to do as good, if not better, than our feeble human minds.
Well, it does seem to be the trajectory of things with AI. And I have to confess, we do use it a lot in different elements. But I do think it still falls short in many of the very final touch translation to the human communication side of things. It's a little tone deaf on some things, but I'm sure it'll improve. Back to that process, I mean, the way you described it as being really challenging, and I mean, that's how I find it. It's, you know, you kind of have this baby that you put together and tended to and watered and nurtured and cared for. And there's a psychological component of having to give some of it up, having to change things that you thought were important or you know, recognize that the way you're framing it or presenting it isn't as effective. It's really hard to do because you're challenging your own assumptions, your own, you know, work product that you've worked on sometimes over the course of years. And I can feel when we're doing that, and we do it as a collaboration with everybody who's been working on the case, and that collaborative process is, it's challenging. And my brain literally hurts doing it. But it's sort of like doing a workout, you know you're having great benefit from it because of kind of the painful process you're going through and coming out the other end with something that's better than you went into it with. But just the process itself has, I think, enormous value. And we use those opening statement workshops not just to, it's really the pretext is getting an opening statement, but really the bigger goal is to frame the entire case and then have a roadmap for how we're going to try the case. You know, what are the themes? What are we going to emphasize as important? What are those couple points of leverage that are going to make the difference in winning or losing? Those are all the things we're identifying in that meeting. And I feel like having you there, bringing an outside perspective and somebody with a fresh set of eyes to the case is incredibly valuable to us. And I would say probably any really smart person who brought a fresh set of eyes would be valuable. But I think having you with your background and experience and knowledge of human, you know, psychology and so forth is even more important. So it's a very, I think, just a critical and important part of our trial prep process now.
Along those lines, I've had people tell me the first time they'll hire me to do an opening statement, they'll say, man, I wish I had brought you in before my discovery, before I did all my depositions. Because even though that seems excessively early, so long before trial, like you said, the framing, it makes you realize, oh man, I really need to amp up kind of side of my story. I wish I had a line of questioning on this topic. I wish I had asked this witness XYZ. The earlier you do this, the more prepared you can be in discovery to get all your evidence aligned with your theories.
You know, that's true, but there's actually a real power in not doing that, because when we get to trial, the case we're presenting is often quite different from what the defense has anticipated based on, you know, a couple years of discovery. And we're now asking questions or highlighting themes that they're not prepared for. I kind of like that. You know, it's like we have, I don't know, it's maybe you come out in the second half of the Super Bowl and you've made adjustments and now you're playing a different game than you were playing in the first half, and they're just not ready for it. So there's a way in which that there's value to that. I mean, it's new to us, but it's new to them too. And new to all the witnesses. They're not anticipating those questions. Can we move on and talk a little bit about jury selection? So, I mean, in my home state of Maine, up until a few years ago, we didn't really have the opportunity to do lawyer-directed voir dire. In fact, the case you came up and helped us pick a jury on a couple months ago, for that judge who picked that particular jury, that was the first time he ever allowed attorney-directed voir dire. So I've learned a lot working with you because we hadn't had as many reps, although I've done it in other jurisdictions. We did one in New Hampshire, for instance, where they've allowed it for longer, and Vermont, done cases there where they allow it. But can you, starting maybe from the simplest elements of it going forward for people who maybe have never done attorney-directed voir dire before, or in a state like mine where it's rare and not available as often or only more recently, give us kind of the basics, the very basic primer on what are the goals? What are you trying to accomplish in attorney voir dire? Let's say you only had a limited time 30 minutes, an hour, and you can only accomplish certain things. What are the highest priority items that you need to do? And then we'll kind of take it there and get more involved from that point.
30 minutes or an hour? I mean, things change drastically. Which sections to chop, what to prioritize, how everything flows. So it's super contingent on how much time you have. The general, starting with a broad psychological principle, you know, my philosophy is you can't change people's strongly held beliefs. It would be futile. You'd be silly to get up in Vordire and think that you're going to get up there and change people's minds. You might as well use that time to figure out what those strongly held beliefs are, specifically the ones that are likely to sink your ship if these people end up on the jury. So the way we structure our questions are all around being honest with yourself about what your case weaknesses are. Don't think that you're going to be able to convince people or win them over on an issue that is a true weakness. So identify your case weaknesses. Start by making a list of, here's the things, if defense is going to win, it's going to be on these topics, or it's going to be because, you know, my client is 350 pounds and is suing over a failed knee implant, you know, things like that. It's like, these are big hangups. So be honest with yourself about what those are. And then
a woman who did fentanyl and heroin throughout her pregnancy, for example, which we had in one of our cases, right?
Yeah, that was quite an uphill battle. And then suing over a birth. So yeah, that's a great one. From the plaintiff's perspective, which is almost always where I am, it is always where I am on an injury case. I like to open with the burden of proof topic, not necessarily because the burden of proof is itself a huge hangup, but because we use it as a nice icebreaker. So that's probably a longer conversation we have time for today. But the point is, you want to get a conversational tone established early. You want jurors to feel like this is a situation where they are meant to do as much of the talking as you are. They're in a courtroom, possibly for the first time, very likely the first time in a jury selection. So it's a foreign environment. It's weird. They're a little caught off guard. When in doubt, they're probably just going to shut down and be quiet unless you put a microphone in their hand. So we use the burden of proof topic as an icebreaker to get people talking about law shows. You know, what burden of proof is normally relevant to those criminal lawsuits they see in law shows. We use that as much to get the conversation going as to ask people's opinions about burden of proof.
Take your playbook to the next level by joining a legal network of all-stars at psrplaybook.com. PSRPlaybook.com is a free digital legal library created exclusively for plaintiff lawyers by the nationally recognized personal injury law firm of Panish Shea Ravipudi LLP, and features video content showcasing the tactics, strategies, and concepts implemented by some of the industry's most successful trial attorneys. PSRPlaybook.com promotes learning, shared knowledge, collaboration, and best practices. Get in the game and see for yourself by joining our national network of plaintiff lawyers. Subscribe now at psrplaybook.com and learn from the best.
One thing I really like about your approach is you get the jurors talking immediately. Whereas a lot of lawyers' approach to voir dire is to start by giving a speech about the process. That's what I used to do. And, you know, there's different types of it, the Keith Mitnick cherry pie or whatever, I don't know, apple pie. And all of that is actually it can have some value. But the problem is just what you're doing is communicating that you're going to be doing the talk.
Right. It's the precedent that you're setting. I mean, think of an imaginary clock on the wall. It's like, and the timer starts as soon as you start talking. It's like, I'm going to be up here talking for 90 seconds, thinking I'm getting through this information fast. But I am establishing the norm that this guy in the suit behind the podium is going to talk to us for the next 30 to 60 minutes. I mean, that is what your actions are saying, even if your words are saying otherwise. This is the only part of the trial where I get to hear from you. And then you go on to talk for 2 minutes. It's just kind of ironic. And why not just put the ball in their court right off the bat? The first question we ask before I say, hi, I'm Ben Gideon. I say, our very first question, how many of you watch law shows on television? Raise your hand, which is so not what you're expecting, because they've heard dry instructions from the court. They've been herded around like cattle all day. And then you get up there with, you know, some papers and looking like you're going to be as formal and stiff as everyone else. And you say, how many of you watch law shows on television? It's just kind of like a departure catches you off guard in a good way. It's like, oh, I'm at the coffee shop with my buddies.
Yeah, and you're not putting them on the spot. You're not asking them sensitive or intimate information about themselves, just easy questions. Everybody watches some Law show at some point on TV. It's
the second question is, how many of you don't watch Law shows on TV? Raise your hand. And within the first 10 seconds, everyone in the room has raised their hand because you either do or don't watch Law shows. And what that does to them subconsciously, psychologically, it teaches them, I am a participant, not an observer in this process. Even if you're an introvert, even if you're not the type to shout out your answer, you're engaged, you're listening, and you know that you have a role, an active role in this process. So that segues into burden of proof, but really it's just more about the establishing that dynamic so that you don't have any snakes who feel like they can just kind of be quiet and end up on the jury. You're more likely to get the haters speaking up because of this precedent, this norm that you've established early on. So even though it does eat quite a bit, and maybe not quite a bit, you can get this section done in 5 minutes or less, it's worth it for what it does to that dynamic. In addition to case-specific weaknesses, that what I was talking about earlier, like with, you know, your drug-using pregnant mother or something like that, there's a lot of topics that are applicable across pretty much any type of personal injury lawsuit. And what the common denominator to these are opinions that people have that are fairly common that would affect your case. So people have negative opinions about lawsuits in general. The most common thing that jurors bring up when we talk about negative opinions about lawsuits is the McDonald's hot coffee. That's like the poster child of frivolous lawsuits in people's minds because of all the media attention it got. Even if the attorney themselves doesn't, they don't bring up that topic, very often a juror will bring up that topic when we're talking about who has strong negative feelings about lawsuits or strong negative feelings about personal injury lawsuits in particular. We want to ask those questions and not in a way where it's, I'm just making sure nobody has negative opinions. Does anyone have negative opinions? If you ask it like that, people are going to say, no, not really. If you say, this is a very common opinion that I know a lot of people feel very strongly about this. Tell me your thoughts about that. Now, just notice the difference in those prompts. I know a lot of people have it. Tell me your thoughts, as opposed to, does anybody have a problem with that? Does anybody? Just those words alone implies maybe you do, maybe you don't. There's a chance no one in this room has a problem. But if you say, tell me your thoughts about that, the implication behind those words is, I know someone in here has something to say about that. Spit it out. And so that's woven throughout our process, the finesse of language. And it sounds like kind of trivial, like people are probably skeptical. Do jurors even pick up on this? But I'm telling you, with repetition, and since you're doing this with every topic, the who else versus anybody else has a huge impact on speaking up. And you're not forcing people to say things that they don't actually believe. You're just encouraging them to speak up in an environment where it's a little bit daunting to do so because there's other people around. It's a weird topic. Even if they have opinions about lawsuits, it's probably not something they think about all day, every day. So you do kind of have to roll out the red carpet for them and open the door and make it easy for this to pour out like a floodgate. So opinions about lawsuits are crucial. Demographics are really boring, but an important part of the process. Depending on what's on the juror questionnaire or bio forms, try to fly through demographics as much as possible, but experience trumps everything. There's another expression that we use all the time. Someone who works in a field, obviously like insurance adjusting and says no to people all day long, or HR also says no to people all day long, wouldn't want anyone in the medical field on a med mal case. There's a number of different occupations and backgrounds, black and white thinkers like architects, construction workers, restaurant owners is an interesting one that you might not expect because restaurant owners might seem like blue collar profession or, you know, they rub shoulders with people of all walks of life. But really, restaurant owners get sued all the time for frivolous stuff, or restaurant managers slip and falls. So they're awful. So those are just some. Even though that's not really a line of questioning you would go into during voir dire, if you don't have that information on the bio forms or jury questionnaires, you've got to find out who falls in at least to these problematic fields really quickly during your voir dire. I guess the final category of non-case specific questions to ask during voir dire is damages. And we intentionally leave damages to the end. The reason we do that is because you've dragged them through the mud on all the bad things about your case. You know, this is a personal injury lawsuit. People hate personal injury lawyers. I know that. My client is suing over an injury, even though she used drugs or had, you know, is overweight or yada, yada, yada. You've talked to them. You've really kind of framed your case almost in a negative way during voir dire. And then you get to damages where you reveal, and by the way, I'm asking for tens of millions of dollars. If damages is delayed to the end, it's all viewed in the context of this is already a weak case and you're asking for a buttload of money. So that's why we hold it to the end. And it's sometimes hard to not mention money till the end because it's such a big part of the case. You really have to sort of withhold that so that you maximize the impact of it. So this is really where the hands start coming up, especially with the fuzzy damages like mental anguish or emotional distress, as it's called in California. So ask about all the elements of damages and really emphasize the ones that some people might view as frivolous, like money going to an estate or money going to someone who is dead. That how could that help someone? Think of all the ways that people would have an issue with the ways in which you're asking for money and ask a question about that specific topic. Always lock it up with a nice and tight cause question. The phrase we like to use is regardless of the evidence or court's instructions. Ben, you've said that a zillion times now, and it sort of becomes redundant. And after saying it a zillion times as the bow that you're tying on each topic, the goal is for the jury to not get hung up on that phrase, but for the judge and the court reporter to hear it so that a hand raise is sufficient to get someone off for cause.
I have to say it's quite effective. I mean, in the two case juries we picked together, we had an awful lot of cause challenges granted. In one, we almost blew up the entire panel, and we're down to just the last half dozen jurors before we could seat a jury.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, you don't have to move for cause on everyone who answered affirmatively to a cause question. I like to view jurors holistically. A lot of times jurors who think in a vacuum, for example, there should be limits on the amount of money awarded in a lawsuit, they're not going to be the worst juror in the world. You know, I kind of think that in a way. I would be a great juror for a plaintiff. But if that's the only bad thing they said for you, that person doesn't need to be. I mean, obviously, I'd look at their occupation and their background. But if that's the only red flag, you don't necessarily need to move on them for cause. A lot of people are worried about my approach because it's like you say, everyone is going to be problematic. If all it takes is a hand raise to one of these questions, we'll bust the panel real quick. So what this enables you to do, I mean, I have dozens of questions, even in my shorter 30 to 60 minute outlines, there's at least 10 questions usually to ask. And you get a holistic perspective of each juror. And, you know, this person raised their hand to everything. And here's the quotes that I wrote down. And these are the actual words they used. So you're not necessarily going to blow up the panel just because you're asking 10 to 15 questions. It just gives you more opportunities to get to know these jurors better. Sometimes you've got a great liability case and you really just want to pick a damages jury. So you prioritize those questions even more because it's like, I'm not really worried about liability on this one. I just need to pick jurors who are going to be open to awarding me lots of money. So that would, you know, pick the jury a little bit differently in that situation.
Can you just talk a little bit about the logistics? Because I think a lot of lawyers are intimidated. You're questioning sometimes dozens of people at once. You're having to assimilate all that information in real time, then you have to have it in a way that's easily accessible to state your cause challenges at sidebar. And often we do jury research before we even get to the courtroom. So you have to have access to that additional information, maybe their Facebook posts and all that. I've found working with you simplifies that in a way that's extremely valuable. Can you just talk about how you do that?
Yeah, so that is a huge part of what I do is not just all the theory and strategy behind all of this, but the actual execution. You know, Jane and I do things differently. Jane does this on a piece of paper, and I'm not a pen and paper kind of guy. So I created an Excel spreadsheet where I track hand raises to these questions. You know, call out juror numbers. I know who raised their hands to each of these cause questions. You don't need to know hand raises to everything. You just track hand raises to cause questions, things that say, regardless of the evidence or court instructions, could not find in favor of someone in a lawsuit who did drugs during pregnancy. That is, you'd want to know who raised their hands to that, but you don't need to know who raised their hands to an innocuous non-cause question. The most important part and the most cumbersome part is you want to have someone on your team who is typing down almost every word said by each juror. It's really hard to organize because you're talking, you know, I have a spreadsheet where every row is a juror and every column is a topic. And each cell, I write down what that juror said on that topic. And because, you know, we generally have some time as the plaintiff to digest our information before cause challenges, i.e. during defenses voir dire, I'm compiling those responses and saying, okay, here's what was said that seemed like it met the threshold of a cause challenge. And I provide a nice clean Word document on my iPad to the attorney so that what they are left with is, here's the jurors that we want to move on for cause. Here is why. And the why is a combination of the cause questions they raised their hands to and the word for word quotes that they stated that demonstrate their bias. And so that process is so much easier said than done. It's important to get those quotes down word for word because you do not want to ruin your credibility with the judge by misquoting. Very often, it's an opportunity to gain credibility with the judge if your notes are more accurate than the defendant's. So be understated about it. There's an art to arguing cause challenges and sort of getting an early edge with the judge as the person who's taken the better notes, who's trustworthy, and who's not embellishing just to get an advantage. The organization part is not easy. The best bet is to have someone on your team whose one and only job is taking notes and have them be very familiar with what your voir dire outline is going to be. So they know what question comes next. They can have their own system for keeping track of all that. But your beautiful outline and effort in the courtroom is useless if you haven't aggregated the information in a way that's useful for specifically for cause challenges. And it happens so fast. Sometimes defense will get up there and they'll say, you know, I don't really have anything to say, Your Honor, you know, looking forward to a great case or something. I've seen defense literally do nothing in voir dire before. And that's the time where I'm supposed to be organizing my, you know, I don't exactly lean back in my chair and take it easy, but I do usually have a little breathing room where I can organize my information. Sometimes you're caught off guard and you're up for cause challenges minutes after you finish your voir dire. So that needs to happen quick. There's a lot of back and forth. Sometimes I'll lean over to the attorney with me at counsel table. I'll be like, I can't decide whether we should move on this guy. You know, what do you think? I didn't like this, that, and the other, but he doesn't seem as bad as them. If we leave him on, then it prevents us from getting to these worse people later on. So there's some other factors that go into, should I move on this guy? It's not just in a vacuum, is he bad? It's also relative to who's coming down the pipe. Like in Maine, you have the 18-pack system where I can't remember if you know the order past the first 18. Do you remember whether like 19 through 80 are numbered or if they're random?
Yeah, right. I don't think you do know.
In California, you do. And so your decision on whether to strike this guy is always in the context of who's replacing him and saving strikes for this terrible run of 4 to 5 jurors later on, who I know I'm going to get to if I move for cause. So I got to save strikes. There's that whole, you know, strike strategy component as well, which is totally separate from the cause challenge strategy.
Yeah, I mean, there's really a lot that can go into doing it in an optimal way. And I mean, it's truly an art and a science that there are better or worse ways to do this process. And if you're getting yourself to court and you are taking a shot at a trial, you really ought to maximize, you know, the decision maker pool that you have, which is by picking the best jury you can. And I've approached voir dire in different ways over the years and followed some different strategies, but I find the one that we've used together working with you is the one I like the most, because it's there's a logic to everything we're doing. It flows in an organic way that lends itself to having a good conversation with the jurors, and it doesn't feel forced, and it feels like every issue is important and real. And so for that reason, the judge, I think, they tend to see what you're doing, and it is every question is germane to the issue of whether these jurors can be fair and impartial and are appropriate for this specific case. So there isn't any question. You're not doing a, you know, I have a dog, you have a dog kind of thing. You're focused on the case and things that are important. And there's an efficiency to it. I mean, there can be a line to cross between having a conversation and letting that conversation spew out of control, where you as the lawyer have lost control now, and it's just the jurors, you know, talking about McDonald's hot coffee case, which doesn't really advance your cause very much over time. And you've taught me how to rein that in, get it back on task, and move from topic to topic efficiently without making the jurors feel like you're not listening to them or giving them an opportunity to say their bit. So it really works well. So Bo, if folks want to find you to work with you, or Jane, for that matter, how do they reach out?
Our website is trialshrink.com, like trial psychology, trialshrink.com.
That wasn't already taken?
No, I know, right? Jane got that in the 90s, actually. That was like a little marketing idea she had that was cute. So yeah, that's our website, but our email addresses are just bo@trialshrink.com or jane@trialshrink.com. We're not hard to find. You can also just bombard Ben with emails and he'll refer you to me.
And Bo is just B-O, B-E-A-U. Well, thanks for joining us, Bo. We have another case we're going to be working on in the next few weeks, and really excited about that one. The last one we did resulted in the highest injury verdict in the history of Maine. So we're doing something right, I think.
Yeah, that was really fun. I'm looking forward to the next one. Yeah, getting that news about that record-setting verdict, that was a highlight of my 2025 for sure.
It was a highlight of mine as well. Well, thanks so much, Bo, and it's great working together and looking forward to the next one. Thanks for coming on the pod.
My pleasure. Thank you guys for having me.
Did we rise to the challenge today? If so, tell a friend. If not, tell us what would make the podcast more valuable to you. Thanks for spending your valuable time with us today. And remember, when we elevate people and we elevate practices, we elevate the profession. Produced and powered by LawPods.